You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Middlebury College art professor and photographer John Huddleston, author of Killing Ground, Photographs of the Civil War and the Changing American Landscape, which was published in 2003 by Johns Hopkins University Press, as well as Healing Ground, Walking the Farms of Vermont, published in 2012 by the Center for American Places. John Huddleston has taught at Middlebury College since 1987. He received his BA in psychology from Yale and completed an MFA in photography at San Francisco State University. He has had one-person exhibitions at the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans, Wave Hill in New York City, Stony Brook University Art Gallery, the MIT Museum, and several others. He won an Andrea Frank Foundation grant for his photographic book, Killing Ground, Photographs of the Civil War and the Changing American Landscape. He has also received grants from the Elizabeth Firestone Graham Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Vermont Arts Council, the Ada Howe Kent Foundation, and the Vermont Community Foundation. His photographs have appeared in Log Journal, Orion Magazine, Harper's, the New England Review, Double Take Magazine, and the New York Times and Boston Globe newspapers, among others. His video work has received awards from London to Tokyo. His photographs are in the permanent collections of the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, the Chrysler Museum of Art, the Crocker Art Museum, and the Berkeley Art Museum. And he has written for the Chicago Tribune's books section. His second book, Healing Ground, Walking the Farms of Vermont, was published in 2012. By the Center for American Places at Columbia College. That's the book we primarily spoke about, but we talked about both of his books. When I spoke with him in 2012, I began by asking John Huddleston about his background in education. I hope you enjoy our interview.
Well, I only took one undergraduate class in photography at Yale, uh-huh. but it was a great class, and my interest just kept rolling after that. So right. I worked on my own for a number of years before applying to graduate school. So mainly I wanted to learn more about photography, but I was also interested in teaching it when I went to the graduate program, and fortunately the job at Middlebury College worked out soon after that.
So after you got your bachelor's in psychology, you'd had one class and you already started working in photography? Were you like showing stuff and selling stuff?
I was showing some stuff, selling a little bit, not much, and I freelanced in New York for a while, which I hated. I mean, it was kind of, you know, photographing businessmen in front of maps, pointing to things or something. It was not good, and I'm not much of a businessman either, so collecting money was really a drag, you know. But I kept my own work going, and that built interest as time went on.
Yeah. So did you ever work as an intern for anybody or learn on the job, or did you just kind of teach yourself?
I taught myself. Huh. I mean, photography is really pretty straightforward, and there's a lot of great books out there if you have technical problems. And I knew other photographers and artists who were also helpful with and generous with their knowledge.
Yeah.
But I never really apprenticed for anybody. I wasn't interested in those forms of photography. Most of that's fashion stuff or studio photographing of products or something like that.
Right. And that's food stylists, things like that.
Yeah, that doesn't have much interest for me.
Now, when you got started, it must have been all darkroom work.
It was all film, yeah. Uh-huh. So the first project, the Killing Ground project, was actually done with a real old-time camera with 8x10. The negative is, the film is actually 8 inches by 10 inches.
Huh.
So a real slow way of working.
So what's the camera look like?
It's actually a real old camera as well. They don't have to be old, but this is an old wooden camera made by Kodak.
Like on a pedestal with the...
Well, you have to use it on a tripod for sure because the exposures are longer.
Yeah.
But it's a wooden camera that kind of unfolds with the bellows and you go underneath. The black cloth and stuff. I mean, the camera was made in like 1902 or something.
Oh.
But they're real simple cameras, but they produce really nice results in terms of detail and color subtlety.
Okay. So the other question I had about your background, but I think I know the answer already, is did you ever intend to do anything else with your life other than photography?
Well, I mean, earlier on, I really didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I worked a lot of construction jobs, was how I supported myself for a long time.
Yeah.
So, no, I didn't know how it was
going to go. So you weren't ever going to go into psychology necessarily? Or
no, I was using psychology to figure out my own problems.
Your future. That's not a bad way to go about college.
Yeah, no, well, I was very confused in college in lots of ways.
Okay.
It was sort of a depth psychology, Jungian psychology. So in general ways, it came in use in sort of a broadening philosophical way, because the Jungian stuff touches on a lot of that stuff. So that was valuable, but largely it was trying to figure out what I was doing and what my motivations and problems were.
Yeah. Okay, so we're here to talk mainly about two projects that you put together, two books, Killing Ground, Photographs of the Civil War and the Changing American Landscape, which was published in 2003, and Healing Ground, Walking the Farms of Vermont, which was published in 2010. And I thought maybe just because of chronology, we'd start by talking about Killing Ground.
Okay.
So in what ways did your background as a Southerner influence you to put this book together?
Well, most of the battlefields are in the South,
right?
So that certainly influenced me. My family was also military for generations back on my mom's side and my dad's side. So my dad was an active military officer in the Army infantry.
Uh-huh.
He was a Green Beret, West Point guy, so he was totally involved with that. So we used to walk some of the battlefields when I was a kid, and he would kind of explain what had happened, what the troop movements were and stuff, and it was unbelievable to imagine that stuff going on, because most of these battlefields are incredibly beautiful pastoral places now, and to imagine that sort of violence there in that sort of scene was very strange and invigorating, exciting, and also, I mean, very fearful. I mean, you know, the slaughter was just unbelievable in some of these places.
Right.
So that was from my boyhood, and the interest, you know, kept going. And the more I learned about the Civil War, the more it's the really pivotal event in United States history.
Mm-hmm.
The southern part, I mean, I guess people have some pride in where they're from, and basically I'm from the South, even though we moved all around in different places. So the pride in the South is also another sort of funny thing, because we're Americans, but we have pride locally as well.
Yeah.
So you know, that was something to investigate as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the fact that most of the battlegrounds are in the South, and that the South sort of, I think, retains more of an immediacy around the Civil War than the North does. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. I mean, and a lot of that is, of course, because the battlefields are there, but another part is because they lost.
And
that's something that people generally don't forget. I mean, the winning side forgets it a lot and is a lot easier in terms of their mental memories than the Southerners would be for losing.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, there are some places in the North, too. There was a battlefield, not a battlefield, but a skirmish in St. Albans, a long time ago. Some Southern prisoners escaped from a prisoner of war camp and went to St. Albans, robbed a few banks. There was a little bit of shooting. I think one or two people were killed. And then they rode their horses up to Canada and escaped across the border. And with the money they had stolen from the banks, they were able to fight extradition back to the United States.
Yeah. That's so fascinating.
Yeah. That town, actually, it is a funny story, because the town, after the Civil War, invited these Southerners back to the town, and they sort of had a reunion over this raid in St. Albans.
Yeah, wow.
Very odd event.
That's very odd. I wasn't planning to ask you this, but it just occurred to me. I have a close friend in Burlington who's very fascinated by the Civil War and has spent his life studying the Civil War. And he finds it really odd and a little disturbing that there are people out there who do these Civil War reenactments, and that they go to the places and they dress up, and that it's almost like a form of entertainment. And I was wondering if you encountered these people at all while you were on these battlefields, and what your opinion is of them. I've kind of skewed your opinion by saying that first.
Well, I did encounter them quite a bit, because I was trying to photograph the battles when they took place, the time of year that they took place.
Right.
So foliage conditions and, you know, weather patterns would be the same. So I did run into a lot of them, and for some it's a form of entertainment, or for the spectators it is. I mean, but some of them treat it very seriously, which is also a little odd. I mean, they're very emotionally involved with what happened on the battlefield. But nonetheless, they're sort of playing at it.
Yeah.
So it is an odd thing that I was, I mean, I'm not too interested in it myself. But sometimes the people were very helpful in terms of, because they really knew exactly what had taken place.
They're very knowledgeable.
Yeah. You know, and some of them were very helpful. But there was a very strange emotional tie to some of that stuff.
Hmm.
And in general, sometimes there's an odd nostalgia about the Civil War, too. I mean, this was a total killing, terrible event. I mean, you know, more people were killed in the Civil War than all the other American wars combined. But people still have a nostalgia. I mean, I guess it's sort of a nostalgia for the past and what they imagine the past could be. But the Civil War times were not good times.
Mm-hmm.
But some people have a real sort of romanticism about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that romanticism was one of the motivations behind the book. I mean, the romanticism goes, you know, it's a hero, manliness, chivalrous sort of affair. But the real side of it is killing, slaughter, amputation, some very terrible things.
Wow.
So in the combinations of photographs in Killing Ground, I use the pictures of the dead or the wounded. A lot of photographs were made by surgeons in the Civil War, mm-hmm. documenting new procedures, new amputation procedures. So they documented a lot of that stuff with photography. So I've used a lot of those photographs in conjunction with the particular battlefields,
right.
to try to undercut that, because I think that happens way too often, and that romanticism of the Civil War.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about the fact that these depictions of war were less romanticized than the painters who used to capture wars before the Civil War. You know, that they used to, I don't remember exactly, here you go. Extensive photographic coverage was also new, breaking painting's long and popular tradition of the glorious depiction of warfare. So I'm wondering if these photographers, is it the nature of photography, is it just the nature of the medium that these depictions would be less romanticized and more starkly realistic, or were the photographers trying to more accurately render war and war experience, do you think?
Well, I think it's probably both of those in a way, but photography does have a more intimate relationship with reality, with visual reality, than painting needs to. So there is that intimate contact.
Uh-huh.
The photographers had to be right there on the battlefields or near the battlefields to make their photographs, where a painter could sort of assemble things, you know, in his studio from, you know, what he imagined could take place.
Right.
I think the motivation of the photographers was, like war photographers are today, like most war photographers are today, is to really sort of present that reality as best they can to people so that they don't romanticize it, and so that young men don't only think that it's going to go off, you know, and be just a glorious sort of affair, that
right.
there's a real other side to it, of killing, maiming, etc., that takes place. So I think that was a motivation of the early Civil War photographers.
Okay. Were most of the photographers from one region or another, the North versus the South, or were the numbers sort of not significantly different as far as...
I think they were significantly different, and what survived is significantly different. So the North was more industrial, more organized, richer, they had more materials, photographic materials were available. But there were some outstanding Southern photographers as well, and
mm-hmm.
I think those guys had difficulty getting materials as time went on.
Okay.
And there was no real support for them. I mean, there was some support and organization in the North. So most of the photographs have come down from Northern photographers.
Now, were they freelancers for the most part, or were they working for newspapers?
Matthew Brady organized it, and he sold individual views of the war, and they made... photogravures, etchings from some of those photographs. So they made some money that way. They made some money selling the pictures. Yeah, so that's the way it happened. And Brady organized most of the people in his studio. He claimed personal credit for all the photographs that his photographers took. And some of the photographers broke away from him after a while to establish their own business.
Now,
but it didn't work out for them in the long run, because right after the Civil War, when you think that maybe once it's finished, people might have more of an interest and a little bit of a distance, but by that time, America was so sick of what had happened. I mean, everybody was the North suffered terribly
and
as
exhausted.
Well. Yeah, so many people had been lost. Everyone knew many people who had been killed, so people had no appetite for it. So a lot of those photographs that Brady had assembled ended up as plate glass in... greenhouses.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of them were trashed. They weren't taken care of. A lot of them were lost, damaged, beyond repair.
Uh-huh. Were the photographers ever in danger when they went into, let's say that they went down to a battlefield where someone from the other side had won, and photographer is perhaps from the north, or a southern photographer is going into a battlefield where the north has just won, and they're going to take pictures. Were they in danger?
They were definitely in danger. I mean, there were sort of artillery shellings were taking place all around, but the photographers were not generally right in the midst of the action because the exposures were so long that they had to wait. Yeah, and the action was so furious that they really wouldn't catch anything on there.
Uh-huh.
But one of the very first battles of the Civil War, the first big one, was the First Manassas, or the first battle at Bull Run. Mm-hmm. And Matthew Brady brought his cart, a photographic cart, down to that battle. And the Union ended up getting routed there. And Brady lost all of his stuff and ended up walking back to D.C. So he really didn't get any imagery from that and was in danger as the Confederates pursued.
Yeah. So typically, they wouldn't be personal targets while they were taking their pictures after a battle, but they might be personal targets if someone came upon them.
Sure.
Yeah. In researching the book, and you've already mentioned him, I'm just wondering, did you end up having favorite Civil War photographers, certain people who you felt that their art was...
Timothy O'Sullivan and Alexander Gardner are two really outstanding photographers who really... They broke away from Brady after Brady was taking credit for all their stuff, but these guys worked extremely hard, were at many of the major battles of the Civil War, and really took very moving pictures of the dead and of the battlefield state. Uh-huh. Of destruction after the fact.
Now, when you say of the dead, I know that there are battlefield pictures of the dead, the fallen, but then sometimes there are portraits of the dead after they, have been sort of like dressed up and their gun is put in their hand. And so why did they do that?
Painting did still have an influence, and in terms of how things were set up, a lot of people tried to follow painting models. So photography was only about 25 years old at the time of the Civil War. So the model, the main visual model, was painting, and a lot of the photographers thought that was sort of a more poetic way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So Timothy Sullivan, the death of a sharpshooter at Gettysburg,
right.
I guess historians have traced that and figured that the body was actually dragged a couple hundred yards into this sort of space between two large boulders and set up there for him to photograph. But nonetheless, so the photograph is not factual in a certain sense, but in a larger sense, I think it's a very moving picture of a young man killed on this battlefield in this sort of lonely, gray, cold spot.
Okay, yeah. Can you name a few examples of the ways in which you tried to honor an original photographer's work in taking your own photo of a contemporary landscape?
Well, so most of the photographs in the book are not one-on-one corresponding views. There are a couple of them, though. There's an old earthen fort that was actually bulldozed around Petersburg and became a Kmart.
Kmart picture.
So that's a very close one-to-one view. So in that sense, I was honoring his.
How were you able to know exactly...
They're really detailed maps. I mean, the Corps of Engineers were very active on both sides, with both the Southern Army and the Northern Army, so they did very detailed maps of what happened, where the positions were on the battlefields. So using that in modern geological survey maps, I was able to really pinpoint where things took place.
Mm-hmm.
And in Petersburg, which was a really extensive battlefield, there's still a lot of that stuff left. So it wasn't hard to find out where that fort was.
Mm-hmm.
After the Kmart came in there, the Kmart survived, I think, for, 20 years or so. Then Kmart went out of business there and became another sort of relic in this space.
In its own way, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the photographs that really moved me... one of the pairs, I suppose. I was so moved by this whole book, and it's too bad that being on the radio precludes our really sharing some of these photos, although some of them will be on the website. But one in particular that caught my eye is in Gaines Mill, Virginia, at the center of the battle lines, site of several unsuccessful Confederate charges, is what it says.
Mm-hmm.
The photo from 1865 shows, you know, many decomposed bodies still in uniform, and it's 3 years after the battle, I guess, that their graves had been exposed over time.
A lot of the enemy was buried in very shallow graves, so, okay. Yeah, so it washed away and eroded, and the bodies lifted up.
Yeah. So then the contemporary photograph that you took and paired with this is in the same town, I guess, maybe even the same spot, I'm not sure.
The battle line was 7 miles long, but this is one of the right along where this sort of action took place.
And we see a little tiny home. It looks well cared for. There are a couple of trees in the yard. It's a pretty little house in a development. And mm-hmm. In the yard is a bicycle that's on its side, and that really struck me because it's like, you know, it's just such a statement about, you know, I don't know, the American dream and what. Mm-hmm. What we fight for anyway. I don't know.
Yep.
I don't know if that's what you were aiming for, but I wonder if you could talk about these two pictures a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it. So it's an interesting transformation that happens in this picture. It is the American dream in a way to have this sort of property. And it's very funny that it's located in such a terribly violent place. But I think we can only be happy about that change of
Absolutely.
The battlefield. I mean, there are some people that sort of would want to preserve everything and have sort of a nostalgia about preserving that stuff in a particular way. But I think this sort of transformation is really positive and wonderful. And mm-hmm. what could be a better resurrection of this turf than what's happened here?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what happened? So these bodies were buried in shallow graves, and then eventually they reappeared. So, would they have been then taken somewhere else and buried and given actual burials, or what would have happened?
Well, it depends on which side they were from. I mean, there was some effort to return some of the bodies home, but generally that didn't happen. There was so much death, mm-hmm. and the organization for that wasn't happening. I mean, mm-hmm. it was even hard identifying the dead. People didn't have dog tags and stuff. I mean, for this particular battle, there was a charge across open fields, and the later battle, there were actually two battles that took place on this, but the later battle, there was an insane charge. There was insane charges all throughout the Civil War over open ground right into the face of the enemy.
Yeah.
So people would, you know, they'd write their names on pieces of paper and pin them on their uniforms so that there would be some identification and their relatives could find out, you know, what happened. Because a lot of times there was just none of that communication didn't take place. They didn't know who it was. They had to get rid of these bodies. I mean, these tremendous number of dead bodies had to be buried quickly before the disease would, you know, infect other people.
Yeah.
It's real varied treatment of what happened, but generally not very good treatment.
Yeah. So you write in the book, a major emphasis of this project is the resonance of history in the landscape. And you reflect in this same passage, are physical and spiritual traces of the great slaughter still present in these places? Which I think we've talked a little bit about, but I wonder mm-hmm. if you can talk a little bit more about what answers you found as you worked on this project.
The places are incredibly powerful, and it's hard to say where that comes from. I mean, I think some of it is really inherent in the landscape, but we're sort of, our imaginations are sort of filling in a lot of material from accounts that, in my case, stuff that I had read, maps that I had looked at, troop movements that I was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some sort of strong effect about standing in the place where this happens. So where exactly that effect is, I'm not sure, but it's pretty remarkable what goes through your mind and what new things you can sort of discover. I mean, a lot of it revolves around pain that took place in these places and our identification with that, how we can sort of empathize with people in a situation that's just totally out of control. They have no control over living or dying, basically. The calmness of a lot of these places, or the way they've transformed in the photograph we talked about from Gaines Mill, also kind of sparks that sort of thinking. So, I mean, in that way, the reality of the place triggers a lot of what is in our mind, you know, from human archetypes or from specific literary readings.
Mm-hmm. When you were taking pictures on land that had been preserved as historical landmark as opposed to developed into something else down the mm-hmm. road. Did you have a different sense of things? Did you find it more or less powerful in any way?
I think they're both powerful in different ways. I mean, the Civil War battlefields that have been preserved are, you know, somewhat like the circumstances that were there at the time. So maybe we can imagine ourselves back into those circumstances a little more. Mm-hmm. Although there has been changes, and there's actually some environmental controversy about some of the Civil War. The sight lines between the Union side and the Southern side were generally totally cleared, or any vegetation that existed was destroyed by a fire from rifles or from artillery. So you could see back and forth, and that was the way the battlefield was. In recent times, they've let a lot of that, a lot of the trees grow back and the forests grow back, so you can't see those sight lines anymore. So that's kind of an interesting and different change. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, you can tell a little bit more what the circumstances were. So then, as a photographer, I was looking for different sort of metaphors or resonances in the photographs. Mm-hmm. In the more developed sites, which are many, I mean, they fought in 10,000 places, I guess, was the estimate. So in some of the places that haven't been preserved, there's more of the consequences of the war take place. I mean, the Civil War really shaped American society in many different ways, economically, philosophically, politically. There was a real unification that went on. The American character changed because of the Civil War. So a lot of those things are a little more evident in what's happening today on the battlefields that were preserved, where people have, you know, built houses or businesses, or, you know, or they sort of become trashed roadside sites or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that I think sort of came from the Civil War. You know, I mean, it's a complicated picture, but a lot of those things can be related back to changes that took place then.
Yeah.
So there's different things that attracted me. I mean, I was happy to see the variety in the landscape. As a photographer working on this project that I think is pretty complex and moves in many directions, it was good for me to be able to choose from a wide variety of circumstances.
Right. Do you have a favorite couple of pairings or ones that sort of spoke to you as time went by after you finished the project that you would sort of think, like, that we could talk about now? I don't know. I'm sure with so many, you must have quite a few that, I mean, they must all mean a lot to you.
There are a lot. I mean, I guess one photograph that, from Shiloh, from this Bloody Pond area, it's kind of an odd photograph and not a particularly attractive one. It's just a sort of a small pond with dead leaves.
Oh, I remember this.
On the bottom.
It's very reddish.
Yes. So the color photograph, the recent photograph, has this odd drain, this sort of rectangular drain in the background that for me is very metaphorical about what was happening to people's lives in this time. So I guess this is a photograph that, you know, stands out for me. But, I mean, most of the pairings have, you know, something that I like.
I'm sure.
For sure, yeah.
Now, is it called Bloody Pond? Is it literally called Bloody Pond?
Well, that's what they called it after the Civil War.
Sure.
Yeah, and the Park Service has preserved it and sort of made, you know, modern plumbing and drains so that it will, you know, survive.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an odd scene, I think.
And the photograph itself doesn't show the borders of the pond. How big is it?
It's pretty small.
It's pretty small.
Yeah, it's a real small. I mean, it's even hard to call it a body of water. I mean,
wow.
Maybe it's 40 feet across, yeah. Something like that, 50 feet across.
Okay. What an interesting project. How hard was it for you to choose what you were going to put in the book and what you had to set aside? You must have had more than just this collection that you had put together by the end.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I mean, I worked on this for a long time, over 10 years.
Yeah.
So there's many more pairings. So I'd say, you know, one out of eight pairings got into the book.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of trying to get a sense of which ones were strongest, which modern photographs were strongest, which pairs worked the best.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a lot of the work of photography is editing, because we can produce a lot of images. And also I wanted some geographical distribution to things as well. I mean, they fought as far west as Arizona, so I tried to be as representative as I could in terms of the different regions of the country where things took place, or the different states.
Now, you didn't include the St. Albans.
No, unfortunately, I didn't do a very good job up there, and it didn't work out in terms of a pairing. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I just wondered if you decided that perhaps that was enough of a kind of wild card, or if you didn't try. Well, not really.
I mean, if the photograph, if I'd been a little better in those circumstances, I would have included it. But yeah. I didn't really get something that I thought was strong.
Okay. So before we move on to talk about Healing Ground, your book, Walking the Farms of Vermont, I have a question about the collections as a piece, if that's even a thing, if that's mm-hmm. possible to refer to. Other than the obvious echo between the titles, I was wondering if you intended to create a kind of synergy between these two books.
Well, somewhat. I mean, I guess the titles really are maybe self-referential to a degree, or the second title is, because the Civil War was a difficult project. I mean, I enjoyed working on it. I thought it was important to work on, but it took a real emotional toil on me. The pictures of the dead are very upsetting to me, and I was dealing with hundreds of those that I'd gotten from the Army Medical Museum in D.C., as well as some of the other photographs that are more popularly known. So dealing with that stuff was really upsetting in sort of a deep way. So I knew I needed to have a more positive project. So that's where the title Healing Ground comes from with the second one, because I thought, well, moving into farming and agriculture, that has to be positive, right? And for the most part, it was. But, as we know, as Vermonters and Americans, there's a lot of problems with agriculture, too, and difficulties for the farmers. So it wasn't quite, healing or rapturous as I thought it would be. But it was moving in a positive direction that I personally needed.
Right, but I think also bringing attention to farmers and farms is healing to that industry.
Yeah, overall, I think the state of Vermont farming is really leading the country in many ways.
It's
in terms of
better, isn't it?
It is doing better. There's more organic farms. People are taking better care of the land. There are more small farms happening in Vermont per capita, and more organic farms happening in Vermont per capita than anywhere else. There's more direct dealings between farmers and the people that are actually eating the food in Vermont than anywhere else. So I think that's really positive, very positive stuff.
Yeah. Do you farm or have any experience with farming, or are you a gardener or anything like that?
I garden a little bit, but I'm not a very successful gardener.
Okay. You just take pictures of other people's farms, and that's better.
No, I mean, living in Vermont, I mean, farming is really a part of all of our experience, sure. I think, because it's so close and intimate. So it made sense for me to also, sort of return home in a way. So the Civil War involved long traveling all the time, to many, many different places. It was really, it became difficult trying to get there in the same time of year, mm-hmm. right? So that made the travels even more extensive and difficult. So it was nice to sort of come home and have the ability to deal with something on a more continuous basis here in Vermont.
Yeah. Did you, in going to various Vermont farms, is it all in Vermont, all of these photographs?
It's all in Vermont, and most of it is in Madison County.
Oh, okay. Did you have to get permissions from people to be walking their property?
No, not really. I mean, most farmers are pretty understanding about this, and I think they realize that the sustenance of their land is not just food that they produce. It's really, there's something about the land and the land being open for other people to walk on and engage in.
Uh-huh.
I think that's really a wonderful thing. I mean, I think Vermont farmers have a real sense of being good neighbors.
Yeah.
So sometimes the land is posted, and I might ask permission, but I think most of the postings are really for hunters. I mean, because the farmers feel, I mean, I've heard some bad stories from farmers about almost being shot.
Sure.
So that's mainly why they're posting the land. But most of the land isn't posted, and I think they're, some farmers would ask me often what I was doing and stuff, but, once I explained that, there was no problem.
Yeah. In the opening of the book, you write, "I am drawn toward the quieter, anonymous places of everyday rural life." I was really struck by that sentence. And then in looking at the pictures, I mean, you're not taking pictures in this book of you're not focusing on the mountain landscapes behind the farms. These aren't pictures that are sort of like magnified to make a statement about Vermont. So
right.
These aren't hyperbolic photographs. These are very focused, real, honest photographs of kind of focusing in on farmers' fields, intersecting tree branches above you, hibernating plants, poking dead leaves out of the snow, things like that. Very mm-hmm. beautiful. But like you say, quieter, anonymous places. I loved that, and I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about
that. Yeah, I think that's pretty important. I mean, our lives, all of our lives are not peak moments of ecstasy. So I think it's really important to try to be equitable across the spectrum of what's going on mm-hmm. with anything that we deal with. So trying to get the more ordinary, everyday thing, that rings truer to me, and I think a lot of people, in terms of what's actually happening in a place.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to sort of pump things up and you know, grind a particular perspective in there are not what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in trying to pay attention to what's happening and seeing what comes out of that sort of quieter, plainer, more ordinary circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
I think photography as a whole has moved in that direction too. Photography is a pretty democratic medium in a way that we can sort of, you know, turn our attention to anything and everything can be interesting and acceptable if it's, you know, done in a interesting way.
Yeah.
So I think the movement of photography is generally in that direction as well, towards a more equitable spectrum across all experience.
Yeah. And it seemed to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed to me like there were more winter photos than summer photos in here. Is that true, or am I making that up? Well, now I'm turning right to summer.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's kind of a distribution between them.
But,
okay. I mean, the transformation is what really attracted me initially to this. Well, it was one of the things that attracted me to this project, because the fall fields go through such incredible spatial, dimensional changes and visual as well in terms
yeah.
of color, space, the intensity of the vegetation that they're growing is just totally transforms the space, and then all of a sudden with the harvest it's gone.
Yeah.
And then the fields continue to mutate through the other seasons, and in Vermont we have, you know, quite dramatic different seasons happening, so all those changes are happening on the same piece of ground, and that was really just startling for me when I started to pay attention to
it. Yeah. I think maybe part of why I said that was that I was so drawn to some of the winter pictures. I loved all of them, but that starkness creates the ability to kind of focus in on, like, beautiful ice patterns or like I said before, the dead leaves coming up out of the snow, things
yep.
like that. I just loved. There was one photograph that was beautiful, but before I read about it, I was trying to figure out, what is this? You know, is he in an airplane? What is it? And it turned out to be actual cow manure. I think it says something
it's
later.
It's a manure pond.
Pond, and it was really interesting, all of the patterns.
In the wintertime, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's got snow on it, it's iced over on the surface, it's very, very strange.
Right, so a manure pond is being primed for fertilizer, is that
yep.
right?
Yeah, so they've collected the cow manure from the barns, and they put it in the pond, and then eventually they'll pump it out.
Use it to spray.
Yes.
And then you told a funny story in your book about...
Yeah, my family was driving in the car. I was driving the car, and we got a little too close to one of these trucks that was spraying the manure on the fields. And it was a hot summer day, and all of our windows were down. And all of a sudden, the manure started flying through the windows, and my wife and daughters were...
Not quite, psyched.
Yeah, no, they were not happy. You know.
I thought that was funny. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the sculptures, your sculptures, which are included in this book. I think someone else actually took the photographs of your sculptures.
Well, a couple of them did, yeah. In that one, there's the ice column sculpture.
The ice columns.
It took me so long to sort of build that I had a planned trip that I had to go on. So I got them up, but I wasn't here to really photograph them a whole lot.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't just a matter of removing yourself from the work.
No. I mean, most of the photographs are all
are
of the photographs are mine, but two of that particular project were taken by friends of mine, you know, who were here and who thankfully documented it.
Yeah. So can you talk about these sculptures? They're beautiful columns rising up out of the land into the sky, and how are they created?
Well, I mean, they're created in different ways with different materials, but basically they're an attempt to respond to the Vermont landscape. So a lot of the ice ones are, you know, have a relational connection with the glaciers that basically created the landforms that we and farmers are dealing with now. So kind of a, you know, a small reminder of that sort of process.
Yeah. How big are these?
The ice columns are 13 feet tall and about a foot in diameter. And there's another one, the ice ring is
an interesting one.
So
that one you photographed, right?
Yep.
And that's around a tree. That's so interesting.
It's around a tree. So, I mean, a lot of these things do come from natural phenomena. Probably some of your listeners are aware of the, after when a river floods and it's at a high stage and then freezing temperatures come in, a lot of the ice will form on the river surface. If it's flooded and is around trees, the ice will cling to the trees, and then the water recedes, and the ice is left sort of clinging to these trees along the riverbank. It's a pretty wild scene. I sort of couldn't believe it when I first saw it. So, and it's only the ice weighs hundreds of pounds, and it's, you know, holding on to the tree by nothing else other than its grip.
Yeah.
So that's where this sculpture came from.
And so you, I
formed this out, yeah.
Yeah, it's a perfect circle around the trunk of this tree and probably, five times the diameter of the tree or something?
Yeah, it's about 5 feet across, it's about five inches in height, and it weighs about 500 pounds. So I put a form there to pour the water in slowly to build up the ice, and then I stripped the form off of there. And basically, this 500 pounds of ice is just hanging there by its...
500 pounds of ice, wow.
Yeah.
So how long did it last?
The ice ring lasted about 3 weeks.
Okay.
And the ice columns lasted, there were three of them. The longest one lasted 5 weeks.
Uh-huh. And what were the months in which you did these?
They were all in the deepest heart of winter, so January, February. Yeah.
Okay. I loved the photograph titled Pods, Grass, Snow. And I also enjoyed at the end, in the footnotes, at the back of the book, you pair the photo with a quote from Gretel Ehrlich, who wrote The Future of Ice, A Journey into Cold. Do you mind if I read that?
Oh, no, please. I love her work.
I never heard of her, I'm embarrassed to say, but I love this paragraph. Our can-do American optimism and our head-in-the-sand approach to economics when it takes into mind only profit, but not the biological health of our planet, has left us one-sided. Too few of us remember how to be heartbroken, or why we should be. We don't look because heartbreak might imply failure, but the opposite is true. A broken heart is an opening heart, like a flower unfolding from its calyx, the one nourishing the other. So I love that quote. I love this photograph. And I'm wondering if you took the photo to go along with the quote, or did you find the quote after you took the picture?
I was familiar with her work and had read that before I took the picture, but the picture was not taken specifically with her in mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so beautiful, and I love the fact that there are so many different tones in this picture of these pods and grass coming up through snow.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm totally biased into winter.
Yeah.
I'm getting ready or something.
Yeah.
Okay, so another photograph I wanted to ask you about, you have a photograph of cows in a stall, which shows them to be in very close quarters. I think it's in the first bit of the book, like mm-hmm. toward, you know, Bill McKibben's foreword, maybe.
Yep.
Yeah, just before that. So they're really tightly packed into this stall, and the way that the shadow's falling on them, it makes such interesting angles and beautiful picture. So I was thinking you must have been angling over the top of them somehow.
This was actually taken at the Addison County Field Days agricultural fair. So the pens are pretty small that they have the cattle in, but it's pretty open to the viewers. I mean, that's why they have them there.
Yeah.
You know, in addition to their competition.
So are you climbing up on the fence to get up above like that, or?
No, I mean, I think these stalls were actually open. I mean, they were closed in the back, but they were open towards the viewers to some extent, and the cows were restrained in those quarters.
All right. It almost looked like you had to be precarious, but I'm reading too much into this, I guess. I was just wondering if you've ever been injured getting a photograph. It just made me wonder if you were in any danger of being crushed by cows when you took this.
No, definitely not with this photograph. I mean, sometimes I've wandered into areas that... There's a little story in this book about going into a swale between fields that looked like it was very shallow, and as I started walking in, this is in the dead of wintertime, and the snow kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and I was really getting up. Yeah, it got to shoulder height.
Wow.
I was totally fooled by it, and I became totally exhausted in there, too, trying to move through it. The snow was coming in on the back of me. I couldn't really go back any easier than going forward, so eventually I just went horizontal and almost... swam and crawled through it.
With a camera?
With a view camera, too, yeah. So the format of the camera was a big 4x5 camera with a tripod and stuff. So I was carrying a lot of weight. It was very cold.
Did you panic?
There was a little bit of panic there, yeah. I mean, because I just couldn't believe it. And all of a sudden, I was really sort of trapped there. It was way out in the fields. I mean, there was nobody ever going to come around to where I was. There was definitely a moment of panic.
You're one of those people that doesn't carry a cell phone, aren't you?
No, I don't own a cell phone, and I never will. But, you know, hopefully this sort of thing.
You'd rather die up to your neck in snow.
Well, I don't know if I'd rather die for lack of a cell phone, but, yeah.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk at all generally about your approach to organizing the photographs in this collection as a whole piece, Healing Ground.
It's complicated. The order of the picture. I mean, one picture does kind of lead to the next, and that could happen through content of the pictures. It could happen through the seasonal thing. It could happen through the sort of crop development that I'm trying to follow, or what I think is sort of the subject matter of it. But there's a formal flow of the photographs too. You know, so our eyes become set up by one color to read another. So it's a real funny process, and I did have some editorial help too. So from other people, the publisher, you know, worked on that and helped me out with that too.
Right.
It's a complex process, and some of it had to do with the actual quotes that are associated with it as well, mm-hmm. that happen in the back of the book. So there's an order that proceeds a little more logically with writing than perhaps with the photographs. So that informed things as well.
Okay. All right, great. What are you working on these days?
I'm working on a project on the Northern Forest, which is coming to an end. So the Northern Forest extends through Vermont, upstate New York, across New England, and up into Canada. And it's one of the largest contiguous forests that we have on the planet. And it's really coming back. I mean, one of the things that I realized with this agricultural book is, I think it was in 1870, 30% of Vermont was forested. And now it's 75% is forested. And this has sort of happened as the farms failed, as the vigorous forest sort of reasserted itself. But it's been happening sort of on its own. I mean, there really hasn't been a, you know, government policy to have this happen. So it's a real interesting sort of dramatic recovery and beautiful recovery of the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in the forest too. I mean, I'm surrounded by woods. So that's the current project.
Okay.
I've also got a project going in Mexico that's nearing fruition too. Oh. Sort of a different project. It's not so much landscape as dealing with sort of the Mexican sense of spirituality throughout history. So I'm photographing the ruins in modern churches and businesses that have religious iconography and stuff in them.
Mm-hmm. Are these for books or are these for shows?
Hopefully they're for books. I mean, I really love the book format. That's how I learned a lot about photography myself, was through the books. Photography works really well in a book form. It's cheap. It's accessible. People can spend as much time as they want with the images. They can return to the images, you know, unlike a gallery show. I really prefer the books. That's where I really think the artwork is in the books.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much in the individual photographs or their placement in a gallery show.
Do you still work with film?
I don't work with film any longer.
Huh.
No. So the Healing Ground was a transitional book where there are some large format pictures from sheet film. There's some small 35mm negatives, and then there's a couple different digital formats in there too.
Okay. So my last question, John, is I was wondering if you had any books that you've read lately or any wonderful photograph collections that you've seen that you would recommend people looking into.
Well, the photographer Robert Adams is really an interesting photographer that I think many Vermonters would relate to. So his main subject matter is the forests of the Northwest,
uh-huh.
and sort of their destruction. But I think they're very beautiful. They're black and white, large format pictures. But there's a lot of feeling in these photographs and a lot of visual inventiveness with his work as well. So he has a number of books. I mean, he was part of the New Topographics movement, which started in the late 70s, photographing the American landscape with the idea of really revealing what the landscape looks like at present, and not going for sort of the peak moments that Ansel Adams, no relation, Ansel Adams really goes for these peak moments where you really see God in the landscape. But Robert Adams' pictures are much quieter and I think very, very meaningful pictures.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's sort of the distinction I was talking about before, as far as like the seeing God in the pictures versus seeing just sort of the quieter moments.
Yeah, very much.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks.
You're listening to WBTV, LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont author and photographer John Huddleston. His work and more information can be found on his website, johnhuddlestonphoto.com. If you are enjoying this show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks so much. We are streaming at 99.3WBTV.org. I'm going to share with you this week's Write the Book prompt, which is to find out what used to be in a place that you frequent. Who lived in your house when it was first built? Were you not the first owner? If not, did you know anything about the people or person who came before you? Did another business used to exist in your favorite restaurant or coffee shop? Did an important event happen on land that you're familiar with? Think about the history of place and then let that history inspire you as you write. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Okay, if you're interested in sharing Write the Book with friends, relatives, your spouse, your kids, let them know that we archive every episode that we ever produce. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes. You can get to, like, I think it's like the last 20 episodes there. And also the full archive is at writethebook.podbean.com. Those are free podcasts. You can also visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you go to my website, please do not use the contact page to ask to be on the show. Use the writethebook@gmail.com email address for that purpose, please. So stream the show live each week at 99.3WBTV.org. That's every Monday at 3. When we are broadcasting, it'll be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. That looks like it's coming down the pike pretty soon, hopefully. If you have guests to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, as I just said, send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. That's the best way to reach me for that. If you put that into the comment area of my website, I might not see it as quickly. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. Have a great week.